This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
So welcome everyone, and thanks for joining us tonight. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Matt Trinker. I'm the Director of the National Museum of Australia. It's great to have you all here. We begin, as we always do, with every event at the National Museum, by acknowledging the Ngunnawal, Ngambri, Ngunnawal peoples, the traditional custodians of this land, this place that we're meeting, and paying respect to their elders, elders past, those of the present and those who are emerging, and to say how grateful we are, really, for the continuing relationship we have with the peoples of this place and the welcome and support that they give this museum's program. It's immensely important to us. I also want to extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who are here with us today. Thanks again for being here tonight for this important discussion, which will explore the history of LGBTQIA plus politics in Australia and look at the ongoing challenges and issues for these communities. And as regulars to the museum, we'll know this panel is part of our headline Defining Moments in Australian History project, which was launched in 2014 and really aims to stimulate discussion and debate about what matters to us in this country, what matters in our history, and how we're shaped, if you like, by the events of the past in the way that we live the present and confront the future. And tonight's panel is themed, as we've said, around this year's all-important 40th anniversary of the 1978 Sydney Gay Mardi Gras March. And this pivotal event was actually on the very original list of 100 defining moments in Australian history. And in fact, the Honourable Michael Kirby will no doubt have something to say about that, because he was instrumental, really, in the move for the museum to adopt this project many years ago. And when it came to fruition in 2014, we were very pleased to have him as a co-patron of the Defining Moments program. It's a special moment, actually, for us, and we were speaking about this before, because the other co-patron, the late Michael Ball, who was so instrumental in encouraging the museum to develop this project over time, is sadly no longer with us. And he would have so loved to have been here tonight for this moment. So tonight we remember Michael Ball's contribution to the museum, indeed his driving force, the impetus that he lent to this project, Defining Moments in Australian History, and we think how lucky we were to have his encouragement in this work. Now, since that original list was released, we've asked Australians to nominate their own defining moments, and people have responded with a great deal of thought and a clarity of purpose in contributing another 300 moments that they think are important to our history, and no doubt there'll be many more to come. And our efforts now are really bent to creating content around all those moments, and for this to be a great resource about our past that's available for the Australian public. So I do want to thank the Honourable Michael Kirby for agreeing to be on tonight's panel and for his continuing support of the Defining Moments project and indeed of the museum more broadly. And a huge thanks too to our other esteemed panellists, to Mardi Gras pioneer Robin Laverack, comedian and writer Jordan Raskopoulos, and Associate Professor from the Department of Modern History at Macquarie University, Dr. Shirlene Robinson. And, of course, a big welcome to ABC Radio National presenter Cathy Van Extel from Big Ideas. And Cathy's a journalist with more than 25 years' experience in radio, and some of you will remember her as a breakfast radio presenter here in Canberra not so many moons ago, Cathy. No, no. Well, perhaps later we'll tot them up. And I'm pleased, really, to report that this discussion tonight will actually be later broadcast on the Big Ideas program, and Cathy might have a little more to say about that later on. Look, we're very pleased at what's happening with Defining Moments in Australian History as a project, and the fact that it's now one of the great drivers of people coming to the museum's website. And I was saying to some people earlier on, just down at Drinks, we're particularly pleased just a couple of weeks ago that a great Australian philanthropist from Victoria, John and Pauline Gandel, have donated $1.5 million to the museum so that we can take Defining Moments into schools across the country. And so, yeah, it is. It was a great moment, actually, to see that philanthropic support was coming for something that we think is so important in our nation, that is to be engaging young people in the discussion about what matters in our history and to be having a dialogue that can reach across the country and can reach into schools. And so, within the next couple of years, you'll see the Defining Moments digital classroom roll out to schools across the country. But tonight, the focus is on the history of the Mardi Gras, on changing attitudes and perceptions in Australia, and indeed the current and future challenges. And it seems to me that it comes at, you know, a very interesting moment for us. It comes off the back of the recent marriage equality debate last year, which led to really those historic changes, which are in fact one of the latest defining moments to go on our list. Some of you, I think, have already had the chance to visit our Explore Gallery downstairs to see the rather beautiful, iconic rainbow crocheted Love Wheels bicycle that was chained to a pole outside Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's Sydney home during the debate and the campaign. It's been donated to the National Museum by its maker, the fabulous Sydney-based yarn bomber, I love that phrase, yarn bomber, Eloise Murphy. And the thing about it, I was saying to someone before, is it's quite beautiful. The crocheting is really exquisite on the bike as well. So we're really delighted to be able to share that great addition to the collection with you tonight, and indeed for you to be able to share in this discussion and debate these stories, and then by extension to take these out into your discussions with other people so that they can reach out across the country wherever you may go. So now I'll hand over to Cathy to introduce our panel in detail and to kick off proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Matt. It's a very lovely pleasure to be here tonight and be reminded of those chilly Canberra winter days. Over the past half a century, Australia has undergone a social revolution in gay and lesbian rights. Citizens who were treated as criminals and deviants or thought to have some kind of disease of the mind because of their sexuality have slowly but surely been edging towards equality. There have been some profound social changes over the decades, but of course the fight for true equality is an ongoing one, and we saw that last year with the marriage equality vote. It gave us some indication of the numbers as well. While the vote was 62% in favour, that meant more than a third of Australians were against, and in some communities there was a resounding no. Tonight's discussion, as Matt mentioned, is themed around this year's 40th anniversary of the first Sydney Gay Mardi Gras March. We're going to be talking about that, some of the landmark fights and achievements in lesbian and gay rights, how societal attitudes are evolving, and the challenges and issues ahead. So I'd like now to introduce our very fabulous expert panellists. They've all lived and breathed these battles and are at the vanguard of the ongoing push for equality. We're very privileged to have with us this evening former High Court judge, international jurist and educator Justice Michael Kirby, a powerful and eloquent advocate of human rights. And Justice Kirby is, as Matt mentioned, also co-patron of the National Museum of Australia's Defining Moments project. In the thick of it all in 1978, Robin Laverick here at the end, a Mardi Gras pioneer. She's a former Mardi Gras board director, founding member of Pride, and founding director of Aurora, which raises funds for gay, lesbian and transgender community organisations. Right next to me here is the fabulous, internationally acclaimed comedian, singer, actress and self-proclaimed raconteur.
I'm a raconteur. I'm also a judge too. I judged the Eurovision Song Contest this year. So.
You did?
I did.
Jordan Raskopoulos needs no introduction, really. And next to Jordan is Associate Professor Shirlene Robinson. She's a historian from Macquarie University with a particular research interest in Australian cultural and social history. Please join me in welcoming them. Our starting point tonight is a true defining moment in Australia's history, the 1978 Sydney Gay Mardi Gras March. Now, Robin, I'd like to begin with you. As I said, you were there. Can you share with us your memories of that night and the lasting impact that that night had on you?
It's interesting because, in fact, it wasn't called Sydney Gay Mardi Gras at that point. It was a Gay Solidarity March. And I had been to many other meetings before this march. There had been a meeting in the morning, a protest meeting. At that stage in New South Wales, homosexuality between consenting gay men was still a criminal offence. And so it was a very strong political activity and a series of activities around that date of the 24th of June that led to that particular night. Why that night rather than the year before or later? But that night, when the parade marched down Oxford Street and the call to the bars was, you know, out of the bars and onto the streets. The other slogan of the night was stop the attacks on gays, women and blacks. It was a very inclusive movement in that sense. I mean, it was driven by the left and the socialists, and so, you know, had a strong political message. But the march that night, I didn't actually participate in until the end of it. I'd been to the demonstrations in the morning, but it was also my birthday. So, you know, politics, birthday, what do? You go to dinner with your friends, so I did. And we were actually up in the Cross when the after the police stopped the parade in Hyde Park, and then sort of ad hoc the march moved up towards King's Cross. And so we came out onto the streets realising that something was happening and not quite what it was until we were actually in the thick of it. And I have to say that was a horrifying time. It was terrifying. It was challenging in every single respect. It was certainly not the first time that police had taken their badges off. You know, let's not forget the Vietnam Moratorium marches. But it was a nighttime. The crowd was cornered. We were circled. There were lots of paddy wagons, and those of us who could ran. There were 53 people arrested on that night. Majority of them were women, and in fact, one of the things we're talking about was that lesbians were very politically active way before 1978, and in fact, were strong supporters of the political movement. And encouraging men to join that political movement to become more active. But anyway, the 53 were arrested. And the next morning there were demonstrations outside the court, and somebody who was here was there. Not gay or lesbian, but there to support their community and their friends. And I think as a defining moment, for me, I actually backed away for a while. I was a young teacher. I was scared of losing my job. I could have lost my job if I'd been identified publicly, certainly if I'd been arrested and charged with the offence. So it was everything, you know, sort of bundled up together on this particular night. But as a defining moment, boy, do I think that it did absolutely change history. In New South Wales, It was a major turning point in terms of political activity. It led to, in 1980, what was then the foundation of Sydney Gay Mardi Gras as an organisation. And it was its second defining moment for me was in 1980 when it actually split kind of its political side from its celebration side and became very much a let's be out, let's be proud, let's celebrate, and by that, let's achieve political influence and clout. So, and then we'll go on to later history.
We will go into some of that history.
But that 80.
Thank you. And from those tears, it clearly still has an emotional toll on you. That's clear.
Yeah.
I don't have too many tears. I've got a feeling of anxiety and anger, and a feeling that we ought to have achieved much more in the time since 1978. And
Michael Kirby, can I take you back to...
And that it's taken far too long and it's been outrageous, and we've got to really make our country a much more liberal, open-minded, accepting, diversity, and really our politicians have got to get with it. And that's, I think, a lesson that we've got to take away tonight.
Can I take you back, Michael Kirby, to... the 70s and the 60s.
Such a long while.
A trip down memory. You were already a federal judicial officer at that point, and Robin alluded to the professional risks that were involved around being identified as homosexual for your sexuality. You'd been living by that stage in 1978 with your lifelong partner, Jan, for many years, and... you were in a situation where you were up against the law, religion, society. What was it like to live like that?
Well, it was not nice. It wasn't nice at all. I was very lucky with Johan because he was from the Netherlands. The Netherlands had never had the British laws that we inherited in Australia. Most of the world didn't have those laws. It was just a dear little gift of the British Empire, and it still is in force. I mean, the Queen had the meeting just a month ago, and of the countries of the Commonwealth of Nations, 54 countries, I think it's still 40 of them have got these laws, and they just won't change them. And they won't change them because of religious opposition. But back in those days, I'd met Johan in 1969, whenever I telephoned him at home, I would ring the phone, it would allow it ring once, and then I would allow it to ring a second time. And by accident today, I rang him, and then it didn't seem to go through, so I rang him a second time. And he said, are we going back to the old days? I have to say, I wasn't like Robin. I wasn't as bold as Robin was, and I had to be pretty careful as a judicial officer. And so I did the deal, and the deal was: we know you're out there, and we know you're not going to go away. But if you confront us, we'll make life very difficult for you. But if you keep very, very quiet and pretend that you are straight, we will leave you alone. And so basically I did that deal, and that was really required of a person in a public office at the time. And it was only really when the AIDS epidemic came along that Johan and I got involved in AIDS activities, and then when you saw your friends, and we had 12 friends who died in those early days, that's when really we began to stand up, because in comparison to the enormity that was going on about us, our own little secret didn't seem all that significant. Mm-hmm. So, but it wasn't a good time.
No, I'm going to pick up on some of the issues around Australia's response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic a little bit later on in this conversation. Shirlene, can I bring you in now? The Mardi Gras is often held up, or that first Mardi Gras is often held up as Australia's answer to the 69 Stonewall riots, which, of course, galvanised LGBT rights in the US. Why do you believe this Mardi Gras here in Australia was so significant, such a significant milestone? And can you give us a bit of a sense, we've alluded to it, of what came before?
Well, I mean, I guess the immediate answer in terms of the Stonewall legacy is that it was the date of Mardi Gras, as Robin mentioned, has changed. So the date that the first one was held was the anniversary of the Stonewall riots. So there was that sort of immediate link. I believe that it was there was a communication between activists in San Francisco and Ken Davies and possibly some other people who I might not be mentioning. But essentially there were issues in California over teachers potentially not being able to teach because of their sexuality. So a letter went out asking for a day to be organised where activities of solidarity would be occurring across the world. And Robin provided a very moving account, I think, of what those, it felt to be in that, and then to see the police respond in the way that they did. And so certainly, you know, in terms of it, this being Australia's Stonewall moment, well, when we think of Stonewall, we think of a community that has been forced to be invisible, that has forced to live in the shadows, fighting back. And actually, if you do look at Stonewall, you'll see that there are examples of communities fighting back in other parts of America well before this, in the 1950s, yet there was something about that time and that moment which captured the imagination of that, of New York and of society, and it made the front pages in New York, not so much in Australia at the time. I think Mardi Gras had that similar resonance. I think as a historian, you don't always get to pick or know when history is happening around you, but sometimes you are swept up in it or you are caught in it, and it sounds very much like that is what happened on that particular evening and that particular day.
And I think you're right, because I think it was a really emotional night. It was the weeks after it, the months after it, the court cases, it didn't end on that night by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, in August of the same year, there was a national homosexual conference where 104 people were arrested. So it kind of kept building this sense of, no, we're not going to hide anymore. We are going to get out there and protest very publicly, and we will bring about change. Ultimately, we will, but it will be a long and hard fight. Whether it should have been a long and hard fight is another, as you...
But don't think that there wasn't resistance. I mean, there was a lot of resistance. The Commissioner of Police in New South Wales, Colin Delaney, said this is the greatest threat to Australia at the time, and there were politicians who really quite decent people otherwise. They had all these feelings of animosity and anger and resistance.
It feels like you're describing 6 months ago as well.
Yeah, yes. You know? And it really, I mean, we saw some of that, unfortunately, in the...
And in 1978, you had the media publishing the names, addresses, occupations of those who were arrested. Extraordinary.
Yes, but we saw the same thing last year in Australia. In modern Australia, we saw the resistance of politicians to a fundamental equality in a civil right by a parliament that could not confer a right to have a religious marriage, and they denied it, and that was about 40% of our fellow citizens. People say it was a wonderful vote. Oh, isn't that wonderful? I don't think it's so wonderful that 40% of my fellow citizens don't believe that there should have been equality for all people, even though the census shows that something like 80% of Australians don't get married in churches at all. They get married in the local park or vineyards or historic homes and so on.
Vegas.
Mind your own business.
Sorry, Kathy, you actually asked for a little bit of, I guess, background and earlier context before Mardi Gras, which I didn't provide. So I will say that, yes, there obviously was activism and a growing political awareness that did happen before that, and you alluded to that as well. And I think it's really interesting and often forgotten that the first deliberately political organisation in Australia that set out to address discrimination and to try and change that through education was actually an organisation that was founded by lesbians, and that was the Daughters of Bilitis. So... I think it's always worth highlighting that. You know, it's sort of a bit of an obscure name.
Now, let's not get any differences between the gays and the lesbians. We're not going to get into a battle as to who was there. We're all in this together,
we're
and
friends
with the straights.
That is true. But, you know, I find this story particularly interesting because, you know, when we think back to 1969 and what it was like for these women to create this organisation, actually, they both independently wrote to the American organisation, Daughters of Bilitis chapter, and then, of course, the American chapter put these two women in touch with each other in Melbourne, so there was two of them, and they decided that they were able to start organising. And from that, they went and tried to place an advertisement in the Age newspaper, and actually for the Age editor to accept the ad, he said he would have to meet in person with one of these women, which he did. And she managed to convince him to publish the ad, which, you know, announced the arrival of the Daughters of Bilitis. And, of course, he wouldn't publish it in the main section of the newspaper, but he did publish it in 1969 in the sort of advertising section of the newspaper. Mm. So that was their first statement. And I think that's a really interesting moment in Australian history.
Yeah. Absolutely. Charlene, let's go to the year after 1978. The police turned up for the follow-up march, but there were no arrests this time, and that was largely because Premier Neville Wran had decided to repeal the Summary Offences Act, which was basically what was used to mass effect the previous year. Homosexuality, though, remained illegal in New South Wales and in many other states around Australia. It was
still illegal in New South Wales up until 1984, which, if you think about it, is not all that long ago. It was actually a criminal offence, not just a summary offence, but a criminal offence. Appalling, really. But, yeah, 1984, finally. And I do actually
think it wasn't a death penalty.
Michael, you're so positive. I love it.
You've got to be grateful for small crumbs.
So, Robin, you believe that decriminalising homosexuality in a way is more defining than Mardi Gras?
Absolutely, I do. And that's not to say that those events did not contribute to that. They did, absolutely, because we became a force that couldn't be ignored. And that's the significance, I think.
I think if a defining moment is a fork in the road, which, having been taken, leads on to other things, as I think, then the Mardi Gras, really, for the first time, people were standing up. And that led on to an awful lot of trouble for Neville Wran. Now, people may have forgotten he was a very powerful, very effective premier, a considerable reformer in environmental and other matters, but he had a lot of Catholics in the party who didn't want to have anything done. And then he went to a Council for Civil Liberties meeting organised by John Marsden, whose sister Jane is here tonight, and he was the president, and they booed him and hissed him, and he went out of there and said, "I'm not going through that again. We're going to get this reform through." And then it was got through in 1984, as has been said. That was a long time.
How much do you think decriminalising homosexuality shifted social societal views?
Well, until it was decriminalised, it was rather dangerous for people to stand up, because then you would be targeted, you would be identified, because you were not only potentially being seen to break the law, but you were also not delivering on the deal. The deal that you keep pretend you're straight. Even this week, I got an email from somebody, some nutter who sent me an email saying that I should apologise to the Australian people. He should apologise to me for having subjected me. It's like saying to Nelson Mandela, "You should apologise for breaking the pass law." And that's how I feel about it. We shouldn't apologise. We should have an apology. We should have people say, "We're sorry that we treated you with such disrespect as a human being, contrary to science, contrary to equality, and we're going to make sure that we don't do that again." We've got to remember that now that we've got this so-called religious freedom right that is going to come up to try and take away the equality and dignity of LGBT people.
Charlene, the flip side of decriminalising homosexuality was that there was criminality on the part of against gay and lesbian, particularly gay men. There was a very strong issue around, you know, attacks by homophobic men, and many crimes against gays were covered up. They were never recognised. They were treated as misadventure or suicide. it's a past that remains unresolved in Australia, doesn't it? Isn't it?
Yeah, and I'd definitely like to bring Jordan in a minute, because I think there's certainly a lot of transphobic violence which I think has been swept under and ignored that we also need to acknowledge also. But one thing I would like to say, when we talk about turning points in decriminalisation, I am struck by something very sad that happened on the bank of the Torrens River in Adelaide in 1972, and of course that's the death of Dr George Duncan, and I don't believe that without that happening, South Australia would have become the first state to decriminalise.
Yes,
I think that was a galvanising moment.
They changed things under Don Dunstan in 1973, I think it was, or 74. So that was the first state of Australia. The British had reformed their own law in, I think it was 1967. So it was England, 67, Canada was about then, and then South Australia, 74.
A fool by 75, everything by 75.
No. Tasmania didn't change until 1990.
It's 1997, but yeah, South Australia was 75.
Yeah, we can't forget Tasmania. They're down there. They're a beautiful island off the coast. And now, of course, they're also one of their very, very forward in things under both political regimes in Tasmania.
I think the parallels, and to talking about the trans experience today and in the last, you know, two decades, you know, agreement that you brought up, that you can live your life so long as you live it in secret, that exists now for trans people. The bigger issue there is that not all trans people can take part in that agreement. You know, we talk within the trans community about the idea of passing and passing privilege and what it means to be a trans person, but to go about your daily life without being recognisably trans. And even well into the 90s, you know, when people approached doctors for help, for treatment, when they were trans, they were held to a degree of scrutiny as to whether they could be treated. And part of that was they needed to, the doctor needed to believe that they could blend and reintegrate into society with no one ever knowing that they were transgender. So that meant the doctor has to assess if they could pass. So
it's rather similar, isn't it? It's back to the deal.
Yeah.
We will accept you if you pretend you're straight.
Well, yeah, but also it's not even just if you pretend you're cisgender. It's I see the breadth of your shoulders. I see that you are attracted. You are a transgender woman who is attracted to women. You're a lesbian. That's not allowed. You need to. You know, if you're balding or if you have a deep voice or whatever. So if I had presented in the 90s, I would have been refused treatment and I'd sent on my way. And trans women at that time knew about this and they made sure that when they went to the doctor, they femmed it up. Trans women would femme it up. They would answer all the questions, you know, in the way to get treated. And when doctors noticed this, rather than saying these people are so desperate to be helped, the conclusion they came to was that trans women are dishonest people. That there is a comorbidity with dishonesty, that dishonest personalities that goes along with being transgender, and that persists socially now. You know, we will accept you in our bathrooms so long as I don't know about you, you know? If you are noticeably transgender, then I don't want you in my bathroom. You know, I don't want to be bothered by it. And I think even advocacy within the trans community now, you know, a lot of around bathroom stuff, because we're talking about bathroom stuff a lot, particularly in the US, you know, a lot of the advocacy, which is well-meaning, is saying, well, this is a transgender man. Do you want this person in your women's bathroom? But the real issue around, you know, bathroom and trans people moving through society is about people who don't have that passing privilege or who don't want to buy into it, who want to be proudly trans, who want their transness to be out there, to be part of their visible identity. And it's those people who are suffering most by this, you know, the social contract you described that is persisting.
Just the very use of the word bathroom. I mean, the American bathroom. Well, there's never a bath in them.
No, that's true.
We call them toilets or lavatories, but it's...
Well, I didn't want to say dunny on a podcast.
Now, that I would have understood. But now we know it's all been revealed tonight. Now we know why Prince William and Prince Harry are so sympathetic and supportive of LGBT, because they're both balding and they've both got a deep voice. So things are changing, but too slowly.
Could I bring it back to a more serious note, HIV/AIDS? Just going, you mentioned a little bit earlier, Michael Kirby, about the way that that crisis changed the way that yourself and your partner interacted in the community. You're a bit more open, I think I read. You felt there was this bigger, greater issue going on. You were very much involved in international committees. Johan was a volunteer assisting people with HIV/AIDS. Was that another important period in terms of shifting societal attitudes?
I think it was an important point in strengthening gay courage, because people had to face up to really terrible events that were going on. I mean, I went to and spoke at least 20 funerals, and you'd go to the chapel or the religious occasion, and then on one side of the aisle, or the central aisle, were the gay family, and on the other side was the blood family, and it was also very sad, and a lot of the religious organisations were very unfriendly and not supporting. And then you'd go to a funeral. Jan was an Ankali, and they are people who help others who are sick. You know, they clean the toilets and make a meal and basically converse, because it was a very lonely time for many. But then when one of his clients died, he went to a funeral, and not a mention of the Ankalis, not a mention of the truly loving support he'd got from the gay family, and the blood family was saying, oh yes, Uncle so-and-so, we used to get together and talk about football and so on, and it was just the deception, the falseness to parents, requiring young kids to be untrue to their families, their parents. It did make LGBT people confront, who am I? Who am I? And to confront that basically on their own, and not being able to talk about it to the people who you love most who otherwise love you. But it really is not a good thing to inflict on people, and it's still happening in Australia today.
Yeah, I mean, I think when people talk about the you know, LGBT plus community, or the trans community, or the gay community, those communities don't exist for people in the closet. You're in a community of one, and you deal with everything alone.
It does have, though, that feature. I was speaking to a young gay lawyer. I didn't know he was gay until he told me yesterday, or the day before yesterday, and he said, he helps me as a volunteer, and he said, It does have this requirement that if you're straight and you feel straight, you don't ever think about these issues. But if you're LGBTIQ, then you are, as it were, forced to look into yourself and ask about difference, ask about reality. And in a way, that is an added dimension to LGBTIQ lives, and it's one that is painful, and many tears are shed on the pillow of young gay LGBT people, and we've got to make life a bit kinder and more loving to people everywhere.
Robin?
Michael, when you were talking about that period, that, you know, first AIDS cases in Australia, 84, only a couple of years later is when, you know, the Reverend Fred Nile is organising demonstrations on Oxford Street and parades up and down, protesting and in fact trying to move for the police to ban the parade from being held.
He prayed for rain.
He absolutely prayed for rain.
God didn't favour him with rain.
Weren't there calls
from the AIDS Task Force head for the Mardi Gras not to go ahead at one stage?
There were, because it was seen as being in some way disrespectful, that, you know, you've got this crisis within your community, you have got people dying. I mean, similar experience to you, Michael. I got to my 100th funeral and I went, I'm not going to any more. This is not the way to celebrate my friends, by celebrating their death. So I decided that, no, not going to do that anymore. I'll just keep fighting how I know best. And that was in 1988, when I actually joined the board of Mardi Gras. And it was a really positive time in terms of saying, this is the next, I'll keep going back to it, another defining moment for me of, we changed the name to include lesbian, and that was a major push, I have to tell you. There were a lot of very misogynist gay men out there. Surprised not.
You have tears in your eyes. This is still painful.
No, no,
for you.
No, that's just the lights.
It's still painful. No, no, it's
it's just raining on my face. Fred and I was praying.
And I think the response of Mardi Gras to the AIDS crisis, and it was described in those ways, was to say, we are not going to stop what we know how to best do, and that is to be an organisation of celebration, to be as inclusive as we possibly can. I mean, 1988 was also the first year that there was an Indigenous float. Obviously, 1988, why you would do that. It was also, as I say, the year that the name changed, the year that we really enhanced the festival. We had a Koori program. There were certainly transgender people involved. There wasn't, I would, in fairness, say, the same level of recognition that there now is. It was kind of,
We're not in the name yet, so.
No. No, it's still
but
working on that.
There's also been change in the Reverend Fred Nile. He actually voted for the expungement legislation. Mm. That was the legislation in the New South Wales Parliament that's been copied or was done in other states that allows the removal of the conviction record of people who are convicted under the old criminal laws, and he voted for it. So, you know, progress is made, and it's just that seem to take a lot of trouble, and there are just... I haven't denied my religion. I remain an Anglican Christian. I'm quite happy about that. Leave me alone. But the fact is, a lot of religions have been really nasty. Why did the Anglican Church, in the weeks before that vote, give $1 million for the no vote, and they gave, I think it was $5,000 to the family violence research? I mean, it's all
barmy. Why did the New South Wales government give $140 million to World Catholic Youth Day, and in the same year thought they were very generous by giving Mardi Gras $140,000?
$140,000
versus $140 million.
Oh well, it's
just
a digit.
Someone left the nought off.
Charlene, you want to say something?
Well, I could say a couple of things about HIV and AIDS, but because the postal surveys come up a lot, I do want to, I guess, say a couple of things. And the first is that I was part of an organisation and am part of an organisation that tried to stop it and actually went to the High Court to do so. So I was very much against it and still am. I think that it's a shameful legacy and a dangerous precedent that happened, but I do think that we should acknowledge that the No side had something like five times the amount of money that the Yes campaign had. That's evident from their spending, and it was published in The Guardian. And yet, despite that, we still returned a Yes vote in every single state and territory in this country. So we have gone on a journey, and I think that we do need to acknowledge that, and we do need to acknowledge that if any other issue or political party got 133 seats back out of, I think, what's that, 150? We would call that a landslide. I think Alan Joyce said that would be the biggest landslide in Australian history. This is not to minimise the pain felt in those no electorates, which, as I said, is beyond devastating, and they should never have known those statistics. But on the other side, we were dramatically outspent. There was a very strong campaign that used very misleading information, and yet still every state and every territory, including Queensland, where I grew up, with the Joe Bjelke-Petersen government, returned a Yes vote.
Well, in fact... In fact, as a Queenslander, our vote was stronger than the New South Wales vote.
It certainly was. And I was in Brisbane to see that, and I can tell you that I did not see that coming at all.
Jordan, while we're talking then about the breakup of the vote, you're in a Western Sydney suburb.
Yeah, I was one of my electorate voted no. And you know, I kind of feel like I live in Minas Tirith in Gondor, on the edge with the great eye of Sauron. But look, I think...
What did that mean to you, having that number there?
I mean, that's the thing, is that regardless of the result, we got that number. We got, you know, we know that 38 out of 100 people decided that they wanted to live in a country that said no to us. And to know that that's some of my neighbours, that's some of the people that I live with. And that was, you know, one of the most awful things about it was that they took elements of the community who do not agree and made us fight publicly. And then when the result came in, you know, the Malcolm Turnbull gave himself a pat on the back for it. And it's almost like shoving someone into a gladiator pit and making them fight to the death. And then when they come out, they're like, congratulations, aren't you happy? You're a winner. And it was awful. I mean, I still am not okay from it. And I think, I mean, the hardest... moment for me was I was booked to sing on the day of the announcement and I had to prepare two songs. And I had to put myself in the position of, what do I sing if my country votes no? You know, what how can I sing? In the end, it was fine and I sang We Are the Champions by Queen, which is a super gay song, by the way. I love that so many sporting events play it and don't realise how gay it is. Because it's about being marginalised and coming out on top, you know. The no song was Don't Dream It's Over.
Why haven't there been... Talking about sporting events, why is Ian Roberts really still the only out footballer? And, I mean, the numbers of sporting people who are open about their sexuality... They must be there in the same proportions as everybody else in the society, including judges. But why does sport take such a long time
to make progress? Sport definitely is behind in a lot of ways, and particularly around trans inclusion in sport.
Yeah.
You know, I was saying, you know, but before this, I used to play rugby and do martial arts, and when I started transitioning, I didn't feel safe staying in those communities, and I didn't want to have to negotiate my transition with you know, in those worlds. I play roller derby now; everything's fine. because it's a community that not only accepts me and the way my body is, but celebrates it. I have teammates who are pleased that I am on their team. I have opponents who are pleased that they get to play with me, Yeah, and I think broader sporting communities are well behind kind of learning about trans bodies and how they interact with the world.
Robin, you were instrumental in bringing the Gay Games to Australia. You were part of the original bid team, is that right?
I was part of the original bid team and we were unsuccessful. And I had the pleasure of going to Washington with Dawn Fraser to bid for the games. We weren't successful because we didn't have a black person on our committee, was the reason that was given, which was a real misunderstanding of, you know, everything about Australian culture and history in some ways. But we were seen as being non-representative. And so we were rejected. So we learned how to address some of those issues for the next bid, and it was successful. So the Gay Games came to Sydney in 2002. It had 15,000 participants, which is more than the Olympics, more than the Rugby World Cup, more than, you know, just about any major sporting event you can name. Michael gave one of the defining moment speeches of all times in opening that. We also had the Governor of New South Wales.
Mari Bashir.
The wonderful Mari Bashir and her husband, Nick Shahidi. And the two of, well, I particularly remember Murray and Nick with their pink pom-poms cheering every single person onto that parade as they came into the stadium. And as I said, Michael gave a most interesting and defining speech that night that friends of ours still talk about. It was a very moving moment for them, as was the whole Gay Games, because it was such an event of celebration, quite different to Mardi Gras in a sense, in that it was an international event. So there were people from all over the world. And in fact, the transgender issues around the Gay Games were some of the most challenging issues that we had as organisers. My partner was the CEO. We had friends on the board. I worked on it at that stage. And trying to negotiate that path around sport and how people competed and who they competed as, and it was in a community that was accepting of difference.
Yeah, yeah. I think those issues that sports are having and communities are having around trans inclusion in sport are social issues. Mm. They're not physical issues. Mm. If those organisations listened to the right, doctors and scientists who know what they're talking about, hormones and body changes, and it's easy. It's you know, a trans woman's body is a woman's body, yeah. And if you plot it, a trans woman's body on a graph against cis women, you know, you put them there. The distribution is within normal ranges for a women's body. So the issues that people need to navigate there are social, and it's weird. Sure, it's weird, but it's okay to say I'm uncomfortable. It's bad to say I'm uncomfortable and I refuse. If you say I am uncomfortable but I'm willing to listen and understand, that's kind of what we need. We rather than flat out refusal to accept the science and accept the opinions of doctors. And so many sporting organisations have got it right. The Olympics have it right. The Olympics have got it right. Roller derby, smashing it.
I think, and in fairness, the Australian Gay Games absolutely smashed it, because they did do exactly that.
Yeah, totally.
They talked within the community. They talked about how to define it so that it was accepted by the trans community. Yeah. I mean, who else to define it?
Totally. But I think the AFL now, and I think, you know, with the way that they made their decision this year was really disappointing, because it wasn't based on the evidence they had. It was based on how they were going to, you know, I presume their marketing, their the backlash, the opinions of the, you know, the papers and all those sorts of things.
But the Pride in Diversity organisation, which has been a great supporter of promoting pride and engagement at work, and which has got the Australian Defence Force and the Federal Police and lots of other federal bodies. It now has an organisation which is Pride in Sport, and they're now promoting this issue within the sporting field. Yeah. But I think we need to promote this also in the LGB group itself, because amongst gay people, you don't always... You get a mirror image often of the general community and a lot of prejudice amongst different components.
And I think that's, you know, the thing with the community. You know, we all stand together at the letters of the rainbow alphabet, because we have a shared experience of living in a society that encourages us to feel shame about ourselves. But our needs are different. And I think one of the big things about the marriage equality debate was it was the biggest issue for our community for a long time, and got to the point where a lot of people thought it was the final issue. You know, even people in Parliament saying, we just got to get this done and it's done and everyone's equal, when there are so many issues that the trans community are facing, the intersex community are facing, gender non-conforming people are facing, asexual people are facing, and their issues aren't even on people's radar. And, you know, I spoke at an event at Mardi Gras last year, which was sponsored by an IVF company, and it was said, you know, this IVF company is supporting the LGBTI community, and an intersex advocate came up with a Sharpie and crossed out I on that poster at the Mardi Gras event, because that company, when doing IVF treatment, screens for intersex conditions and destroys embryos that have intersex conditions. And how can a community of intersex people feel pride in who they are when they know that a company that does that is a sponsor at Mardi Gras, you know? And when, you know, I didn't know that. I didn't even know that was a, you know, an issue. And I think that's a big thing, that the, you know, other letters in the acronym have issues that we're not even listening to or hearing or recognising.
It's a good thing about this program that it'll take out into the Australian community the fact that the issue isn't over. We're going to face very soon the report that hasn't been revealed so far about faith communities, and it will be a terrible thing if we go backwards and, having secured marriage equality, then we're allowing people, contrary to the anti-discrimination laws that are in place, we're rolling that back and saying, well, you can just be nasty to people, just like they were to Rosa Parks, moving the barrier in the bus so that she had to go and get up at the back and she wouldn't do it. And that's what they want to do. They want to revive hatred and inequality and discrimination. And I do hope that we don't go backwards. I hope that our parliament doesn't agree to that, and I don't think it will.
And is there energy for another fight? Is there a, I think there's a fear that everybody thinks that the fight is won and that the ball is being dropped. Is there a concern that you need to muster up the troops again for another fight?
I think I would like to say something to that, which is that we in no way could have won the postal survey without the support and solidarity that was showed from so many sections of the broader community, but also within our own community. And, you know, that includes people, intersex people, transgender people and gender diverse people who are experiencing very real and very immediate and very pressing issues who still, you know, stood with us in that particular moment, because I think that there was that sense that we were bigger together, and that postal survey became about something much bigger than marriage equality itself in the end. I mean, this was about so much more than that we were fighting for as we waited on that results day. And I think if there's any lessons to be taken from that, it is that during the postal survey, we organised on a scale and a level that has never been done before in Australian history. And I think that we were able to achieve something with that, and that we must use that momentum and we must use that energy to repay that solidarity and that debt that was given by people who were placed in a really precarious position by irresponsible no campaigners who put out very misleading and very inaccurate information and really put those people in the worst type of situation. So certainly I think that everyone I know who was involved in that campaign certainly does feel an obligation to keep working on that because of that.
And I think that the difficult thing for the future is that we have achieved so much for gay and lesbian rights, that young people growing up in the next generation who are gay and lesbian are going to grow up with the privilege of being broadly accepted in society, broadly celebrated in society, and are not going to have the perspective or the experience of the history.
And this isn't as different, is it, really? If we think of our country, Australia, it's had a really checkered history about prejudice and discrimination against certain minorities. It had prejudice and discrimination against Aboriginals, and still has in many ways. It had prejudice against people of different colour. We had the White Australia policy until 1966 and 73. It had prejudice against women and inequality in the treatment of women. And it had prejudice against people with disabilities. It had prejudice against LGBT. And we have made progress, there's no doubt
absolutely.
About it. But this is a commonality. And I think what we have to do is look at our country, look at its history, look at what needs to be done. And that's the advantage of this museum, the Australian National Museum, of having these artefacts, having these images, having programs like this, and focusing on our history and learning from our history and seeing it as a whole, not just seeing different categories.
I agree. I guess my point is that we need to recognise that there is a generation. You know, there was the article that was published during Mardi Gras last year, written by a 19-year-old Shaw old boy, who wrote an article about why do we need Mardi Gras anymore? My life's fine. My friends all accept me, and I'm happy. And so that is a young person, an adult, who is so disengaged with the history and so disengaged with the needs of the broader community
that they decide that they're done, that they're going to hang their head up and they want everyone else to finish.
He possibly thinks it's the same about Aboriginals, but look at what happened with the voice from the heart, the wish of the Aboriginal people to have a voice into our federal parliament. Mm. It was just dismissed out of hand. It wasn't even publicly debated. They got their whole community together at Uluru and they came up with this. That's an amazing achievement to get the whole Aboriginal community together. And I think it's very important that LGBTIQ people should see their struggle in the context of the struggle of the Aboriginal people, the struggle of women, the struggle of other groups in the community, the struggle of people of colour, the struggle of minority religions and so on. And we should be in there trying to improve our country because we've had a real thing about this. And that's what I hope the Defining Moments Project is going to identify the history and how we have had many wrongs, but how we have made progress and how we've got to continue making progress.
But Jordan, can I just add something to that and just say, Jordan, I think, you know, I really appreciate that you emphasising how important history is and that people must know this and we have to continue to maintain that solidarity, and it is so important that people know that there are members of our community who, you know, stood with us and who are still experiencing, you know, financial disadvantage and huge problems, and that we need to stand in support with each other, I think. We've shown what we can do and we must maintain that.
Jordan, can I ask you about your electorate where we had that strong no vote in Western Sydney? Mm. It's a very strong multicultural population there.
Yeah.
What are the issues there that need to be addressed? I know that you've thought about perhaps transferring Mardi Gras to Western Sydney as part of the solution.
I think there is something to be said for, you know, because there are community members living in those areas. There are LGBT people within those religious communities or within those, even those geographical locations who are feeling the pain and feeling marginalised by the people around them. And I think as the broader community, we should have a look at that and going, well, how can we make their lives better? And maybe that is programming more Mardi Gras events in Western Sydney. Let's, you know, have a parade in Parramatta, you know? Like, let's go, well, these... This vote has given us an indication on where these pockets of hatred are highest. What can we do to make the lives of LGBT plus people living in those communities better?
And I'm glad you raised that question, Kathy, because we should also not just be little islanders. We should not just be looking at our own position on the Pacific Islands and in many countries, most countries of Asia. I mean, there's still violence. Brunei has just reintroduced the death penalty for homosexual acts in Brunei. In Bangladesh, young gay activists are slaughtered and so on throughout our region. And we've got to be engaged with all of this. This is a human rights issue of the whole world. And we've got to be serious about it and make sure we're not just thinking of ourselves in Australia. We've got to take Robin's example and her message back there in 1978, and we've got to take it to our region and take it to the world, and we've got to be stronger in that respect.
In what way? How do you see that happening? What role do you believe that the Australian community can play?
Well, I think Australia should be an enlightened leader for the community. You know, at least under President Obama, I don't know if it happens under Mr. Trump, but American embassies around the world would fly the rainbow flag on Ida Hot Day in order to send a message to those beyond the wall. There are people here who are concerned, who support your struggle, and don't give up. And I think Australia should... Some ambassadors do it in Australian embassies, but not many. It's a bit like what Anwar Ibrahim said. We were rather quiet about his imprisonment.
Yeah.
Sometimes we've got to be a little bit more noisy and stand up for the values we believe in.
And I think you know, individuals, governments, but also corporations in the way that they interact with you know, customers and partners overseas, I think there's a role that they can play there. I mean, I fly Qantas, and I often gig in the UK, and Qantas used to do stopovers in Singapore, and now they do stopovers in the Middle East. I am not allowed to be in certain countries in the Middle East You know, when we had a gig in Germany, the people in my band, you know, stopped over in the Middle East, whereas I took several flights to make sure I didn't land in a country where I felt unsafe. You know, I can't enter Dubai, you know. I could probably stop over there, but if I tried to go through, I would be arrested for who I am. And, you know, a company like Qantas is partnering with companies in those countries. And that's something to think about.
In fact, let's pick up that point about the power of corporations, because in Mardi Gras, particularly in the 90s, when there was a real head of steam behind the event, there were massive numbers. I think at one point in the sort of early 90s, it was up to 500,000 people involved. The corporates really got behind it. It was a sort of powerful shift in society, because it was seen as a commercial opportunity as well.
Oh, absolutely. The pink dollar, which was what everybody wanted to get, it meant that organisations like Playboy were bidding to be a major sponsor of Mardi Gras and to have their sort of iconic bunny ears as the Mardi Gras symbol. What don't they get about what Mardi Gras' focus is and what Playboy's focus is? But it was commercial opportunism.
It's called sex.
There is that. But they wanted to make a dollar, and that's fair enough. I don't question that. But there was no alignment between their corporate values and our corporate values as an organisation.
In fairness, you know, Pride in Diversity has gathered many of the big corporations, because the bottom line dictates what they will ultimately do. And the bottom line shows that when LGBTIQ people are comfortable and open about their sexual orientation, they work, they get more. It's good for the shareholders, it's good for the corporation.
It's dangerous thinking, though, because if the bottom line switches, or if the bottom line says something different...
Yeah, but it won't
switch. No, but my point is, you know, companies say, well, diversity within a working group actually increases productivity. Even if it didn't, There are reasons to be diverse.
You're right.
Which is to not be cruel to the people in our community.
No, absolutely. It's a human rights issue. But on the other hand,
the invisible hand is not a social justice hand.
There has been progress with the big end of town, and now they're taking that into health and diversity. Karen Phelps is the patron of that. And now they're taking it into sport.
Yeah.
And,
because there's definitely challenges in the community.
The next
that are
one
not
we've got to take it into is the faith communities. Mm-hmm. Because the faith communities got plenty of LGBT people, many of them frightened, many of them very silent. It'll be a good thing when all of them come out of the woodwork. And then maybe one day we'll live to see this whole sorry saga. If every LGBTIQ person in Australia stood up, the whole pathetic deal and the whole pretending would be all over. And that's really an important goal we should all set. And I thank Robin for her leadership back there when I was being a very quiet little telephone twice person. You stood up, you went out there, you went on the streets.
Many other people,
yes, but you did it. It was harder for me, but I did it in a different way when AIDS came along, and we've got to get more people. I still know judges who, you know, don't ever, they're back there in the two telephone era.
Yes.
And we've got to get that all changed, because it's so unscientific.
Robin, I'd like to pick up on something that you mentioned a little earlier before we came on stage, and that was, despite all of the profile that you've had and despite the societal changes and the improvements in attitudes, you still live with prejudice. You still live in a small community town where there's a sense of other.
Oh, definitely. I mean, my partner and I have been together 25 years. We are referred to as the girls because I don't think people know what to call us. They could try calling us Robin and Judith. That would work. But when amongst... And the rest of that community is straight, but amongst that community, that's how they refer to us. They don't refer... Whereas we would say Mark and Bev or, you know, whoever. No, we're always just the girls. And so there is still that separation, and with that comes a bit of a demeaning of our relationship and who we are. I'm reflecting on some of the things that people have been saying. I'm sick of fighting. When you ask, you know, is there strength to go on? Well, I'm over it. I was over it for the marriage equality debate. I mean, I marched, but I did nothing else because I'm sick of having the bloody fight for what should be basic human rights that I should have as a basic social equity within my community.
Yeah, but don't give up fighting, Robin, because it's the spirit that you had in 78 that started the roller coaster and it's still going on. And we must never forget that the greatest achievements for LGBTIQ people would not have happened without the support of straight people. I mean, that straight people came on board, began to question it, began to question their attitudes, began to question the fairness of it all and the ignorance and unscientific nature of it all. I think that's when things started to change. Yeah. We've got to keep that momentum up.
Jordan, you came out as transgender in 2016 with a video that you put on Facebook called What Happened to Jordan's Beard?
Yeah.
Thank you. We have come a long way from, you know, the 70s, 80s and even the 90s, but you were still worried about the reaction. Was it a fear about what impact it would have on your career?
There were all sorts of fears about career, about whether I could, you know, persist doing what I did, how people would receive me, whether people would still be turning up to gigs, whether the people, you know, even before I came out to the people in my band, whether they would accept it or... And so many questions. And for me, I wanted to tell a story of continuity because so many trans narratives that had been told up until that point and during that time, because that was the time that Caitlyn Jenner was coming out, were about change and were about starting over and about a new life and a new personality. And I saw Caitlyn Jenner give her final interview before she disappeared to transition, and it was, you know, a thoughtful, deep, moving interview, and then her first act when she came out was to be in lingerie on the cover of Vanity Fair. And I thought, what a difference of expression and how gendered it was and how it lent into the tropes that are so toxic. And I didn't want to do that. And so for me, coming out was about expressing the continuity in my life, that I was the same person, I loved the same things, I was going to continue doing what I did, which was to sing funny songs. I was going to come out doing a funny video on YouTube, which is what I do, funny videos on YouTube. And I was going to sing in the same voice, you know. And my journey with my voice has been one of the most important journeys of my life because, you know, one of the things I, as a singer, was like, do I need to sing like a girl? Is that a thing I need to... In order to be accepted as a woman, do I need to sing like a girl? Do I have to sing in a girl's voice? And doing that would mean abandoning half the notes I can sing and only being able to sing so high. And what a waste. You know, my voice is a gift and an instrument, and a part of the thing, you know, the journey that singers go through is understanding the instrument they have and their capabilities, and not every voice is the same and different voices are capable of different things. And my voice is great at a really great rock growl. And the thought that I had to abandon that made me sad. So I decided I was going to sing in a girl's voice. I was going to sing in my voice, which is the voice of a woman, because I am a woman, so my voice is a girl's voice. So all of those, you know, journeys, you know, were happening at that time, and it was hard to balance how much I let out publicly. And I think that was, you know, the hard thing that I, you know, met lots of people in the community while transitioning and before I'd come out publicly, but no one really had a perspective on how that would go or how that... And I'm glad it went well.
You also learnt the importance of a mentor, and you very much decided to become a mentor yourself.
Yeah, look, I think I wanted to be the person that I needed when I was younger, you know. And I wanted to tell the trans story I wanted to tell. And I get emails from people who say, oh my God, I didn't know I was allowed to transition that way. You know, I didn't know I was allowed to keep on liking video games. And, you know, and I've had people, you know, contact me every day with all amazing stories. You know, an older trans woman who had lived her life in stealth for 30 years sent a message to me, says, I'm not doing that anymore because I saw how important it is that you... your transness is part of your identity and how you're proud. And I want to be proud of it too. So I'm not living stealth anymore, which means to live, you know, appearing cisgender and you know, buying into the contract that we spoke about earlier. And she decided after 30 years of the security that came with that contract to abandon it and be proud and be an advocate. And I'm so pleased that I've had that impact on people, and I'm so privileged to hear these journeys that people go on and to know that I made an impact. But similarly, I recognise that I benefit so much from the fact that I lived for 32 years as a dude, and I wonder often that if I had transitioned earlier or if I had been born as a cisgender female, if I would have been afforded so many of the opportunities I received in my life. And the knowledge of that privilege doesn't make me feel guilty, and I think this is a message that we should broadly talk about when we're talking about privilege. The knowledge of that privilege doesn't make me feel guilty; it makes me feel responsible. And when you have privilege, you don't need to be guilty about it. You don't need to be ashamed about it. You need to recognize that you have a thing, you have an advantage that other people don't have, and you have to ask yourself whether that is fair. And if you understand that it is not fair, then you are responsible for fixing that. You're responsible for dismantling toxicity. You're responsible for sharing that privilege that you have. And so the reason that I take this so seriously and that I put myself out there is because I want to live in a world where anyone would have had that opportunities, whether they're cis or trans or man or a woman, and that is my responsibility.
We've come up against time. And on that very positive note, we might open it up to audience questions. I think we have a microphone that can be passed around. If you could just indicate by raising your hand. There's a microphone there, a hand just there, Luke.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you for the... Yes, you're right. I should know. No. Thank you, Kathy. Thank you for the panel for addressing the questions of gender issues. I think in terms of transgendering, we've come a long way. Only a few years ago, being transgendered was not only career-threatening but thoroughly dangerous. And these days, due to the efforts of many, many people, including one particular senior army officer and a couple of priests, we're getting better exceptions of this. But that's not universal amongst the health professions. For instance, in WPATH, what they call the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, they encourage the pathologization, terrible word, isn't it? Can't even pronounce it. But amongst their standards of care, they state that before hormone therapy should be prescribed by doctors, they should demonstrate persistent, well-documented gender dysphoria. What do you think it does for the reputation of these self-appointed professionals, and do you think that they need some education in being effective gatekeepers?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, I noticed that when you said the phrase gender dysphoria, I noticed you kind of spat it out. I don't dislike that term because the previous version of those guidelines was gender identity disorder. So at the very least, we have established that being transgender is not a disorder. And gender dysphoria, the language there is that gender dysphoria is discomfort and distress that one experiences when they notice that their gender identity does not match their body or the way that they're treated in society. And that absolutely describes my experience. And that's not, you know, that's on a social level, a physical level, a hormonal level, internally. Like my body, once I was exposed to estrogen, felt normal. you know, and I lost some of that distress. I mean, there's probably always going to be some level of pathologization with trans people because it requires a treatment. I think we need to discuss the gatekeeping and we need to discuss there are issues with it, particularly when we are talking about gender non-conforming people, non-binary people, or people who are trans and don't want to pursue that that route. But also, you know, bringing in a situation of informed consent as well, that, you know, people should have autonomy over their own bodies and they should have the risks of transition explained to them. They should be helped if they have any other disorders that are not related to being trans. I think it's a complicated thing and I think there's more journey to go, but I think we are at a better place than we were, like you said, 5 years ago.
We might have time for one more question.
I have a question for Michael about just unpacking this.
Have to speak up, I'm sorry.
Sorry. Unpacking the challenges that face us with the religious freedoms debate in a human rights context so that balance between respecting people's rights to choose their religion and not discriminating.
So the question between balancing the rights, religious rights and human rights, something we were talking about a little earlier.
Well, I think that was well expressed by a philosopher in terms that the right that I have to swing my arm finishes when I hit your chin. And I think that's the same in terms of the rights of religious freedom. I believe in the right of religious freedom. It's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it's in the International Covenant, and it's part of our history, and there are legal protections already in place. But the question is, do we claw back the protections against discrimination in order to accommodate some people's desire to assert their religion in the public space in a way that interferes with the dignity and feeling of equality and non-hostility of LGBTIQ people. Take the cake makers. I mean, this is now before the US Supreme Court, and we'll hear what they say under the American Constitution shortly. But for people to say, well, I don't want to make... I'm in the business of cakes. I make very good cakes, and especially very good wedding cakes, but I don't want to make a wedding cake for people who are lawfully married in this country under the Marriage Act. And I want to be able to say to them, I'm sorry, I don't do it because I have a religious view against what you have done. I have a difficulty with people being able to do that. At the moment, under anti-discrimination law, then they probably can't do that. And people can have their religious views, but if they're in the business of making cakes, I don't think their religious view is going to reach down to the fact that they could be hurtful, discriminatory and refuse to observe equal conduct in the public space for people who want them to make a cake. They should go and become merchant bankers or something like that.
Get out of the cake game, If you can't make cakes for everyone, do something
else. And the florist game.
Yeah, and the photography game.
I mean, that we have yet to see this particular cake maker that has this problem. And, I mean, if you think logically about this occurring, you'd have to find somebody, I think, as Trevor Evans said in Parliament, you'd have to find somebody who basically cared, a cake maker who cared more about, making a particular point around this particular issue than they did about their business, then you'd have to find another another person who cared more about, you know, having their cake made by this particular baker, you know, than they did about actually having a cake for their wedding. So, I mean, these two things coming together, you know, hopefully are unlikely to happen. But I would make the point that Australians voted to remove discrimination and not to introduce any more. And I think that should be the takeaway that everyone put forward last year.
And no wedding cake is going to be as disgusting as a hen's night cake.
In fact, in the United States, the case before the US Supreme Court is actually about a person, a couple, a gay couple who wanted to have a cake, and they found actually, only in America this, they found a cake maker who didn't want to put happy wedding Joe and Craig, and therefore they've got that exact issue before the US Supreme Court.
They do, but and you we'll know in a few the population weeks, of America, they've found one.
Yeah, it's a very rare situation.
And they're more litigious, I think, than Australians are generally also. Yeah.
Well, I think you'd agree it's been a really engaging and illuminating conversation, so thank you for that, and thank you for being a great audience as well. Matt, I'll ask you to come back for the farewells.
For a very short farewell. What a great conversation. What about a round of applause there? You know, we've had so many discussions and debates in this room and actually down in the main hall in the course of the Defining Moments project, but I really mean it when I say tonight that this was very compelling and absorbing, I think, for all of us in the room. And not just that was the temper of the discussion, but just how much that I think it goes to the very centre of our experience the last 30 or 40 years in this country, and trying to plot, I think, as we did through the course of this change and then the need for more change. And if history can do that for us, then it has a virtue, I think, in our lives to think about the past, think about what the past has meant, to understand it clearly, to see it honestly, and to take some lesson from it as we confront the future. So, again, thank you to our panel members, so superbly led by Cathy Van Exel. Thank you. I do want to thank the staff of the National Museum of Australia who, as always, are just so superb tonight in putting this together. I want to make special note of Lily Withicombe, who is a curator who's responsible for the rainbow bike, the love bike downstairs, being on display. If you haven't seen it, take an opportunity to see it. It's a great story. As I said earlier, this panel discussion will be broadcast on RN's Big Ideas program at some time in the future. Listen to RN and you can find out when, or indeed come on our website to have a look from time to time, and we'll let you know the minute that we've heard when it's going on. I want to thank, always important to thank your sponsors, Capital Wines and Cooper's Beers. You enjoyed their wares at the beginning, and remember the name when you visit your bottle shop. If you enjoyed tonight's discussion, look, there's plenty more. Watch for the next discussion under the Defining Moments rubric. And indeed, watch out for our blockbuster summer show that's coming in September, Rome, City and Empire. And there'll be a great discussion about why Rome still matters to us today and perhaps for the future on December 5. We hope to see you then. Thank you all.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.